Please allow me to welcome you to the Nerdist Podcast number 324. The Nerdist TV show is coming back to television, BBC America, Saturday night, March 30th, after Doctor Who and Orphan Black. Brand new Doctor Who, brand new Orphan Black, it's a new series. And the Nerdist TV show has, we've evolved it a bit. It's a little couchier now, it's kind of nice, got stand-up on the show, it's a little bit longer, segments breathe, got some comedy sketches. So that is the Nerdist TV show coming back to BBC America Saturday, March 30th. Check it out. Also, Talking Dead is currently on now. This next week, guests are Scott Adson from 30 Rock and Retta from Parks and Rec, and a special surprise guest. That's Sunday at 10 p.m. right after a brand new Walking Dead. The day for that would be Sunday, February 24th. I think that's, yeah, that seems right. February 24th. Yeah, good. All right, 2013. Who knows when you're listening to this, or if this has been fired into space and it's generations after, and you don't even know what these words are because you're an alien in space. And so this could just sound like feedback to you until you figure it out and then get addicted to human podcasts. Yeah, you like human podcasts, don't you, aliens? Yeah, you do. What am I doing? Why are you shaking your head at me? Really? I had to draw that out of you?
Oh, I've been sitting here wanting to make that joke this entire time.
It was worth it. Just like it's worth it to go to squarespace.com. That is a fucking segue, Chloe Dykstra.
Oh my god.
For future reference, if you ever start your own podcast.
I'm so turned on by how good that segue was.
Well, you'd be turned on by the fast and easy website creation that you can get at squarespace.com to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. You're going to get the best mobile experience, too. They have new templates, mobile-ready responsive designs. When you add an image, by the way, you're going to get 7 different versions, so the correct size loads for whatever the device is. Your site's going to look professionally designed no matter how it's viewed. Super fast and easy to use, drag-and-drop functionality for all customization tools. There's a new page builder tool. You basically add blocks of content like photos, videos, text, social media. They're immediately previewed as the layout goes. And this makes it easy for anyone to build a site. Squareface.
Why do you keep calling me that?
Oh, man, I was going to cut that part out, but now I got to leave that in. Squarespace gives you better social media integration. Automatically import, sync, and publish to and from social media with just a few clicks. And dynamically refresh your site and content, raising awareness across all of your social landscapes. It's exceptionally well designed. Squarespace is just gorgeous and easy to use, and they have great customer support. There's a free offer right now. Go to squarespace.com/nerdist. Sign up for your free account. No credit card needed. You try it out. You start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase, use the offer code NERDIST2. Nerdist in the number 2. Get 10% off your first purchase on a new account. Squarespace.com. Use the offer code NERDIST2. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. Now, this podcast is 3 people. It's Neil Patrick Harris, who's come back. By the way, you should check out Neil's Puppet Dreams on the Nerdist YouTube channel, youtube.com/nerdist. My tongue gets tired at the end of the day, is what happens. Stop staring at me, Squareface! Neil Patrick Harris came back on the podcast because he's directing an amazing magic show called Nothing to Hide. Neil's the president of he's basically head of the Magic Castle, which is awesome. If you're ever in Los Angeles, try to score yourself an invite and bring a tie. It's awesome. And so he brought on the 2 magicians who are doing this incredible live show, Heldor Guimarães and Derek Delgadio. So they came on to sort of talk about magic and the show, and it was really, really fun. I love, you know, I think everyone enjoys magic, but it's really great to, you know, sit down and talk to a magician on a human level and sort of figure out where they're coming from and what magic means to them. Because it's not always just for us to go, holy fuck! But a lot of times you do, and especially you will if you do this. Nothing to Hide is running right now at the Geffen Playhouse. If you go to geffenplayhouse.com and you're in or near Los Angeles now or around this time, go see it. They keep extending the show, and I am so excited to see it. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast number 324 with Derek, Helder, and NPH.
Now entering Nerdist.com. Sibilance. Sibilance.
Sibilance. Audio. Segue. Start. Cough. On.
This is one of the. This is one of the Seacrest on. Studios.
I'm going to be
start like, on. Perfect. Hello. I'm, this thing. Check.
This is my position.
Check.
For
privacy. Audio. Auto. Start. Nick. Nick. Can I? Okay. Nothing. I'm fine.
Doesn't work. Doesn't.
No.
Son of a.
I blame Ryan.
Yeah, this is a Seacrest studio. I'll have a word with him. I'll never have a word with him. Welcome, gentlemen. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Hello.
I'm sorry you were waiting in the lobby for like 20 minutes. I didn't know what to look for. I was hoping smoke would appear and then you guys would just be in studio.
All they do is practice their coin rolls over their fingers.
You know,
and triple cuts.
Ever since I saw Val Kilmer do that in Real Genius, I always wanted to do it, but my left hand sucks at everything.
I just want to be the one like in Labyrinth and do the.
Oh, that's Michael Motion.
Yeah, I know it is.
Oh my God. And when Penn Jillette was on, he told the story about how Michael Motion and he were childhood friends and Penn had the balls. And
so to speak,
and Michael was like, do you mind if I play around with those? And so Penn has some responsibility in
nice in that. Making that happen.
But let's talk
I think introductions are
please
due. Oh, have we started?
Yeah. A lot of people say that.
I see.
This is Derek Delgadio.
Hello
Derek.
And Helder Guimarães.
Nice. You're getting it.
Yeah, I'm getting
it.
They are I'm going to say it, the two best close-up magicians going right now.
On this podcast.
On this.
For sure.
You haven't seen my close-up magic.
No, that's true.
But you're right. You're still the best ones. Yeah. Yeah.
They are currently doing an unbelievable show. They're both.
I don't think you're allowed to talk about it that way anymore.
Fantastic.
Because you.
What's the best magician term for you guys? You like magicians or close up artists or artists in general or like what's that? It's sort of like you can
spooky
be racist.
Hands?
No, you can be racist in that way in a weird way. Like if you say the wrong African American terminology to the wrong African American person, then you end up saying something offensive, and the same holds true with magicians. If you call them show me a trick is
or
not appropriate. It's
magic
more
face. That's very offensive.
Magic face is that's like bad.
You cape wearing card jumpers.
Yeah. Card jumpers is good.
I didn't really
box
like,
jumpers is a
like
real
card
thing.
Jumper.
Card jumpers is pretty good. We'll go with that.
At any rate, I am this is Neil Harris. I am the present. Well, people are listening, dude. They can't see my face right now.
They recognize your voice.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Even like this.
Oh my, who just came in here?
I am the president of the Academy of Magical Arts, which is where the Magic Castle, the organization within the Magic Castle walls. Derek is our reigning close-up magician of the year. Of 2012, he won close-up magician of the year. Helder, the reigning 2012 parlor magician of the year. These two gentlemen came up, have their own amazing individual acts. They joined forces to do a show in the downstairs Peller Theater. If you're
dark,
of the Magic
dark
Castle.
Forces?
Dark magical forces.
How do they determine who the best magician of the year is?
We're right in that right now. It's March, and all of the members get to vote. Magicians and magician members vote. And you can go online, and hopefully you've seen a lot of the performers, and you get just sort of like voting for the Oscars or the Emmys or something. You vote for your top five, and then...
I want to see, like, wizard duels.
Yeah, I think you have a different idea of what happens at the Magic Castle.
I've been there many times.
Yeah, but there's no dueling wizards.
There. Well, there should be.
There.
You're the president. You can make that shit happen. I love the Magic Castle. I was just there when my friend Andrew Goldenhirsch was performing, and who is a wonderful close-up
He's
magician
great.
As well.
He can take a piece of paper and turn it into a butterfly.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
He does a lot of other things too, but I don't want to give them away.
Agreed. I just gave something away. At any rate, Derek and Helder are currently performing a wonderful like hour plus version of this show that they did together at the Peller Theater called Nothing to Hide at the Geffen Playhouse, which was supposed to only be through the beginning mid-January and then pushed for a couple weeks. It's extended again and again, and it doesn't seem to stop. It's sold out, and they had their single highest ticket sales for the history of the Geffen for this show.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so it's a big thing. And what's nice is that most people don't get to see a lot of magic. in their lives. And when they do, it's kind of cheesy. And when they hear about great magic, like at the Magic Castle, they're not able to go, really, because they're not magician members or no
magician. Or maybe they don't own a suit.
Or maybe they don't own a tie and a suit, which is part of the dress code. So this allows people to be able to see this awesome type of magic done as good as you can possibly see it. With just, you know, a few dollars.
And I imagine that magic is sort of probably one of those things, the analogous comedian thing is a one-man show, where it's like, oh, someone's putting up a one-man show. And most of them are not amazing, but when you see one that's really incredible, then you're like, oh, shit, that's exactly what it's supposed to be like.
These dudes are the Louis C.K. of card magic.
Oh, my God! Together.
Yeah. Fuck yeah!
But do you have sort of... Are there slightly different focuses because you focus on close up and yours is parlor magic? So there's a big bigger of a stage show. Was there an idea to combine those two things into a mega thing?
It's actually the size is not the main difference between parlor and close up. I think the difference is as far as I'm concerned, it's more the level in which you perform. Which in close up magic normally you work on more in an horizontal level, and parlor you work on a vertical level. But the size, it's not that much of a difference. Thanks very much.
Is that better?
Oh.
Yeah, now it's in here.
Did I repeat everything?
No, we got it.
Okay, cool. And actually, I think it's just our styles of performing that fit those criteria better in those rooms. I said criteria. I should have said criteria.
Carteria.
Carteria.
Oh, it's a new word.
But I don't think that it's like that doesn't really matter at the end of the day. When we join to do the show, part of the pieces would be considered pieces for a parlor situation, another pieces for a close up situation, and we can go back and forth on any of this. Thanks.
I do feel like that no matter how cynical or how hipstery or how negative people are about magic, when they do see a fantastic performer, it's like Justin Willman does a show every once in a while at our space at Meltdown. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a lot of young nerdy types, some hipsters come in there, fine. But watching people react is as fun as what's happening on stage when something will, you know, he'll pull something off and then people from the back cannot not go, what the fuck? You know, like that kind of, I don't imagine that that's what people shout out at the Geffen Playhouse, but they definitely
do. They do.
I mean, magic is inherently amazing. And as long as the magician doesn't get in the way of it and allows it to communicate, then people usually react accordingly.
How do you develop that confidence?
What confidence?
The confidence to let the magic speak for itself and not try to over-talk it, get in the way, you know, over-perform it.
I think understanding it on a level bigger than than a performative level, but what, you know, what it can be to an audience and like what magic is to people right now and what it has meant throughout the ages. And if you allow people to experience it in like a pure sense, then with you know, without their defenses going up, then they're able to really experience, you know, what is hopefully mystery, you know, which is amazing and doesn't happen very often these days.
Is there sort of a renaissance of magic right now where there's a generation of young magicians who are trying to sort of redefine what the image of magic is?
Magic can be broken down into so many different types. So I think there's a great renaissance of kind of the magic being cool again is a general idea. But then, you know, you look at Burt Wonderstone as the movie that's coming out, but that's like big illusion magic, which is so different from
that's Vegas magic,
card magic, right? And you have mentalists that are sort of in the middle of all of that. So I think thankfully it's an art that's not dying, but it's a very specific. It takes a very specific breed and a very specific type of person to keep it alive and keep it new and refreshing, because you can just go to a magic shop and buy a couple card tricks and learn them and teach your friends and then claim that you're a magician.
Right.
You can say you're an illusionist and spend $50,000 on illusions that people build and then, you know, go to Branson and say that you're a magician and doing an illusion show, and then you could be called an illusionist, right?
Oh, I never really thought that.
Because you can, right?
Sure.
I mean, there's people hawking magic books, magic sets at Costco, but there's also people who study the craft, who know the history of the people who originated moves, who have perfected said moves. And with cards, it gets much more hyper-focused and much more dexterous, mm-hmm. legitimately, not a ton of trickery is involved, that you can deal seconds, you know, where you're dealing the second card instead of the top card, and you can stare at someone's hand and not have any idea that that's what's happening. You can deal from the middle of the deck. You can totally fuck up a deck and then it's back to normal. Like, you can do things, they can do things that, and I sound like they're shill pitch man, but legitimately, when Derek says that he likes to operate from a level of that's bigger than the trick, I think that shows in what they do in their performance, because it's not just like, ta-da, right. And now your aces are on the top of the deck, but they turn things into a much bigger thing that is really kind of mind-blowing.
So where is it? What is it? Where is the excitement for you? Is it in the performance? Is it crafting? Moves? Or where do you love the most?
Well, I think it's a mixture of everything a little bit. But what I think that makes this show different from the conventional magic show that you'll find in a bunch of places is that our idea of doing a show is actually to communicate an idea. The magic is a way of expressing an idea of what we believe should be the world we live in. So that's just a tool almost to get to that point of sharing an idea or several ideas during the show. And magic, it's a way of communicating like stand-up, like dance, like theater, like cinema. It's just a way of communicating ideas. And most magicians, they think that just by doing the magic, they are doing something. You know, they are expressing an idea. And sometimes they are, but sometimes you don't know, and it's just a trick. And it's just a trick. There is no idea. There is no concept behind. There is no philosophy. There is nothing. It's just, I go to the magic shop, I buy this, and this is a trick. Here you go.
It's just like someone playing scales without substance.
Yeah. Like, you know?
Or reading a joke book and reciting all the jokes they memorize.
Right. Singing karaoke.
You can buy a book. You can buy a book with jokes and read it, and you are not a comedian.
Right.
So I don't believe if you go to a magic shop and you buy a trick and you do it, that you are a magician. That doesn't enter my way of thinking about magicians. Magicians are people that are more serious about what they do, and they study and they research and they create and they craft and they practice and they spend literally years of their lives before they go on stage doing something.
These
guys are at the top of the game, mm-hmm. right now, and I think a lot of times you don't get to the top of the game until you're 65 years old or 70 years old when you're respected and revered, and like the Di Vernons and people like that. And so I think it's great that we are in a time where contemporaries of ours are able to be this good and skilled at what they do, because I think it makes it more accessible and it makes it, dare I say, hipper to be able to come and see this show with two guys that you not only cannot believe what's happening, but that you actually want to like hang out with them afterwards and have a drink.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that's what makes it cool, because a lot of magicians are hyper pretentious because they're holding secrets and withholding secrets and they know more than you, and there's kind of a pompousness to what they do.
And they're also not, you don't see them as like people.
Engaging.
Oh, yeah, I did that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that guy goes home and takes a shit and gets into bed. Like, you just don't think of them as people. You just think of them as these sort of caricatures of.
That's kind of the it's still, you know, pervasive, but it's also the old model. And now more than ever, I think humanity is the most important thing to inject into magic. And mm-hmm. so to become more human and still do magic is more important than to become some sort of, you know, omnipotent creature.
Sure.
Yeah, a wizard. And so yeah, it's a I don't say a problem, but the place that most people begin magic in their lives, or the why ends up pushing them towards a person that doesn't really have a place in this world anymore. And so it's really important to try to make sure that you keep, you know, the fact that you're a real person in the show. And we make points of that in our show where we try to intentionally remind people that we are just people, because it makes anything we say or do more likely that people will listen, because it's another human being and not just some, you know, thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you get, as you begin your journey into magic, how do you start to get on the inside where you start actually learning? I'm just curious, like, where does it start for you, and then how do you get in?
It's like comedy in the sense that you have to just be great. And, you know, if you're a great stand-up on a stage and you're just working on being a great stand-up, someone in the back of the room who's been doing it for 20 years is going to notice, and they're going to, you know, mention, hey, great set or good job, and hopefully take you, you know, under their wing a little, maybe show you the ropes.
That's the difference, though. We don't. It's not like we can really apprentice people in comedy, because you could just go, hey, that was a really, really good job. Those are really cool. But there are actual specific skill sets and things to learn and manipulation to learn. And so it's not just...
Sure.
Like you can actually, when someone mentors you in magic, they're actually, that's like a trade. There's, like they're teaching you something.
But I've heard lots of that same stuff in comedy.
But you'll
get the Jerry Seinfelds and people that will take someone and say, hey, I have a suggestion about this trick. If you rattle through it, you might get a better laugh. Or if you hold, you know, like don't some people do that? I mean, they're not so...
They can give you tips, but it's not like, oh, here's a new thing that you haven't learned yet about how to manipulate this thing in a way, you know, like, especially with comedy, because everyone's voice is different.
Yeah.
You can kind of say like, oh, well, try this or explore this. I mean, you can speak in broad terms, but it's dicey when you start telling a comedian, start doing your punchlines this way. Start, right. Do this. You know, you can tell people like, well, don't look at the floor.
Right.
You know, but you can't really, it's much harder. You just have to do it to learn it. You can't, there's no like going home and, you know, like trying to practice it and trying to pray. You just have to do it in front of people.
Did you guys have mentors? Is that sort of how it happened? Like you were younger magicians that were enthusiastic by magic, and then you found someone that was really, really good and they started like teaching you more?
Yeah. I had many, but it's also mentors in the sense that it's similar that you know, you just look up to someone and admire what they do and ask them questions, and even if they can't even give you an answer, because the answer I got from most of the guys that I looked up to was you just got to go out and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it really still begs the question, how is someone's listening to this podcast and they love magic, like where do you plant yourself physically to be able to be around people who can mentor you? Like you just go hang out at the magic shop and like head in that direction? When you say lots of people, like did you go to magic camp?
No, didn't go to a magic camp. Yeah, just to find them if they were doing shows or in town, maybe giving a lecture or something, I would attend. And, you know, when I was 15, I sat in front of the Magic Castle, even though I couldn't get in and all my friends were inside playing, and they brought me out a bowl of chili eventually.
Were you living in the cold on the street?
Basically, yeah. And, you know, if you want, you'll find them, and they'll, and if you have talent, they will find you and they will hear about you. And I was a kid in Colorado and, you know, and would meet people, you know, a year or two, you know, after I may have done something, and I'd meet someone I'd never met in my life. And they'd say, wait, you're Derek from Colorado? I've heard of you. And I'd be like, okay, this is pre-internet, you know, that stuff. So I don't know. I mean, just be really good at what you do, or try to be really good, and, you know, and it's, I think it just happens.
What about you, Helder?
Well, for me, it was a totally different experience, because my father did and does magic as a hobby. So that's how I started. I was 4 years old. And
a serious
I.
Serious hobbyist, though.
Like, well, very, yes, very but serious. Still.
Where did you grow up?
In Portugal.
Okay.
Yes, I'm Portuguese. By the way, if you didn't notice that I don't speak English correctly, I'm Portuguese.
You just spoke English better than most Americans speak English, because you used an adverb.
I said English.
Most Americans would say, you probably just noticed I didn't speak good.
Yeah, that's true.
Bad grammar. Your grammar is perfect.
So my father did magic as a hobby, and I was looking, like I was literally four when I looked up to him, and I was like, can I try to do something? And my kindergarten party was around the corner, the Christmas kindergarten party. And my father knew the owner of the kindergarten I was attending. And the owner had asked him if he could do something for the kids. And my father said yes. So my father, when I was around him, said, "Do you want to do something?" And I went like, "Sure." So he teach me a couple of tricks. And at that point was literally just tricks, nothing else. And he basically, I did it. And that's my first show when I was four. And
so was he your mentor then through it
and
all?
And then he always he has really good taste about magic. So all the people he looked up for are people that I still think they are heroes.
Sure.
And great magicians.
You're really lucky because most people's parents don't have great taste in stuff. Whereas like when you think about the things that, when I think about, I love my parents dearly, but when I think about the things they like or the comedians they like and stuff, I would not say we share a lot of tastes in terms of like really great.
Well, yeah. In magic actually has good taste. In music,
but I like that there must have been a certain point where you were like, "Father, my powers have exceeded yours, and it's time for me to move on." Yes.
Actually, that was I remember the moment I felt that, and I felt uncomfortable.
Of course,
I was twelve, and we did a magic competition together, and I stayed in front of him.
Wow!
And I was like, "Oh my God, this is weird."
Was he okay with it?
No, he was. Hey, he's a father. He like he.
Well, you beat him, but
I mean, after the show, it didn't go well.
No, he was super happy for me, and he couldn't be happier. He's like, he really wants my success and me to be happy. So he was the first one to rave about it. But for me, it was like, oh my God, I don't feel right about this.
What about you? How was your family?
Different. I have a very different upbringing. Single mother most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
She was a teenage mom and did her best to, you know, she did amazing. She's a firefighter now.
And, oh, wow.
She's incredible. And she's a lesbian. So not that there's anything wrong with that.
I said that like in a porny way.
What if Neil was one who was like, "Oh, really?"
Ew,
like that'd be
disgusting.
So weird.
Disgusting.
No, Neil, you're Neil.
What's wrong with you?
No, Neil, you David. What? There's David.
Beg your pardon.
You have a
someone else is talking right now.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's disgusting.
I didn't grow up with a father. Do you have violin music you could play now over the?
I do. Oh, I wish. You know what? We do have a sound effects board, but it pisses people off.
All right, that's fine.
So I think we'll just go with the Neil's analog mouth violin.
So I didn't grow up with a dad, and I think that is really where the pain started. No, that's where I think a lot of my drive towards once I started doing sleight of hand and magic, and I found this sort of free Big Brother program. Although I think the real Big Brother program is also free. But this sort of Big Brother program in magic. And I think there was a lot of, drive for to please like these paternal characters.
Oh, sure.
And even though I didn't have a dad, I think that like I had many surrogate fathers in a way. But my mom more than made up for it with, you know, what she did. She's incredible. It also allowed me, I think, more opportunities because my mother, I think, knew that that was something that was missing. So she would let, like, when I was, like, you know, 14 years old, she'd let me get on a Greyhound bus and go 80 miles by myself to a small town where I heard there was this guy who I wanted to meet, a magician. And so I had really amazing opportunities.
That's great. Hey, did you guys ever... want to do
are you
more
now,
than no
podcast?
I have questions.
Okay.
I just love that. I love the potentially dicey nature of I'm gonna hop in a Greyhound and go see a magician in another town. Have fun.
You know what? It was
potentially pedophilic.
Where did you grow up?
Colorado.
Which part?
Colorado Springs and Littleton.
Littleton.
Yeah, I wasn't.
I lived in Littleton.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, Littleton.
Yeah. I lived in Littleton. I was in high school I went to Regis High School.
Oh, okay.
But I lived in Littleton, and when we lived there, it was basically just a prairie. Like, you were fucking...
Yeah, I was in the Columbine area.
Yeah, I went to private school, or I would have gone to Columbine.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't grow up with money. So I was
we didn't grow up with a lot of money, but my mother forced it all into education.
Hey, that's a good place to put it.
Yeah,
it was. Yeah, no, Littleton. I grew up, spent a lot of time in Littleton. I mean, and then moved to Colorado Springs, which is where my mom is.
What year were you born?
Currently a firefighter, 84.
Okay, 84.
Yeah.
I'm just, when I hear people from that, because it's, yeah.
Yeah, maybe we were.
Were you like a creepy old guy on like chat lines trying to get younger kids to go learn
a magic trick?
Yeah, but unfortunately,
in 84, no one knew what those were.
That's true.
Oh, no, this would have been 15 years later. Yeah, I guess I could have been.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess I could have been in like 98. Sure. Well, the magic news groups or whatever we were doing in the chat rooms.
Looking to teach some cups and balls.
No, I'm a magician.
Anyone want to drive 80
miles? Why am I not getting any calls?
My magic lair.
Why am I not getting any calls? I need to change my branding.
Did you guys ever want to do different magic besides card stuff? It seems like you're focused on cards, both of you.
Well, that's really, we talk about this all the time. People make the assumption that that's what we do, cards, mostly because that's what they see us do. But we look at it all as the same thing. I mean, magic is magic. It's like
stage illusion.
Sure, if it's the story's done right, you know. But it's like, if it's a feeling, it's not a you know. I have nothing against stage illusion. In fact, it's the hardest type of magic to pull off.
Why is that?
The Max Maven, mm-hmm. Who is kind of he's the patriarch of knowledge, and everyone looks to Max for answers and things. And he once did an essay or something about how the most difficult type of magic is actually stage illusions, because it is very clear when watching a stage illusion show that the magician has very little to do other than wave his arms and dance.
Right.
Basically.
That's kind of what you were saying about the Branson thing.
Point,
yeah.
And point at the thing that does the thing.
And look at this machine.
Look at this thing that I bought.
Yeah.
And you're welcome.
Yeah.
And so it is the most difficult in the sense that to get an audience to have a feeling, a visceral sense of like magic, while watching a box do a thing on stage is very, very difficult. That's why David Copperfield, you know, is David Copperfield, is because he got people to feel those moments when he was really doing his thing. He really got people to feel magic, even though, you know, he was basically just holding his arms up like, you know, a girl displaying a car.
And what do you think that secret was? Like, what is that? What is that?
People drunk.
Yeah, you get them really drunk.
Well, David Copperfield was good at the vignette. He was actually able to tell a story within the thing. It's a hard thing for a stage magician to tell any kind of story in, like, with like rock music playing and wind machines and stuff, right?
Like, that is the one consistent element of any good art form, whether it's a painting or a television show or a movie or stand-up. It's just like, the story has to be good, and the story has to be authentic, or at least seem authentic and be organic, and you know.
If the story is good, they'll forgive anything. People will forgive anything, and you know, if the story can carry, you know, a good story can carry a weak anything, really, and even a weak magic trick, and in stage, you need people to go on that emotional journey, where they get rid of their intellectual intelligence, you know, and it's emotional intelligence instead.
True. You really need that more than anything in magic. You have to sort of let your head get out of it. You know what I mean? Like when you go to the magic castle, you can sit there and be angered by all these people who are doing things that you can't figure it out. Or you can have a couple drinks and wander around and just like love the close-up magic and go and see and love the palace show, and you meet some guy and he shows you a card trick and it's all just amazing. You kind of have to give it up a
little bit. You're a troglodyte, you get mad at it.
Yeah.
Because like if someone's like, this hurts my brain, but you know, why would you go watch magic if you were just going to get mad? I guess people do.
It's different types, analytical types or whatever. It's fine. But and sometimes you can't help but go there if what you're seeing is shitty. You know, if you're watching a shitty magic performance, you can't help but just, it's reduced to, how's this working? Because I'm not going to let this asshole be smarter than me. Which is where your mind goes.
Well, especially, and I mean, I would almost think that performing for drunk people could be, you know, I mean, at least with stand-up, if someone's hammered, you can directly engage them and then just sort of spin the show about that. But I assume that when you have that kind of a performance, then it's just as like, come on. Or if someone's going, I see how you, what is it? You know, how do you guys deal with hecklers?
You can do the same.
Yeah.
I like actually to tell people to shut up a lot. I like it. I really like it. Because I think people don't understand how disrespectful they are being. Not for me. I couldn't care less. I'm doing the show every single day. And tomorrow, if this show is not going to be good, tomorrow probably is going to be good. But for all the other people watching the show, like, that's so disrespectful that you think you are more than them. And it's okay to have an occasional heckler that says a funny thing. That's different than someone that is trying to ruin the show.
To derail the show, you know? Which is usually a drunk
totally
person.
Totally different.
I don't know if you're present at that. On the main stage at the castle, at the palace once.
Don't call it main stage.
I had the palace. It's just bigger. Yeah, the big
it's
stage.
Bigger. It's a bigger stage.
Yeah, it's just bigger.
Yeah. I was doing a show and there was a woman who was heckling. And she was being playful, and I said a couple of things and tried to shut her up, and she was playful again, and now she's being disrespectful. And I said, all right, I tell you what, miss, we are going to let the audience decide the next time. So if you decide to interrupt one more time, we're just going to let the audience decide and maybe, you know, have to ask you to leave. And so she immediately said something else. I went, I think that was your last chance. Audience, should we ask her to leave? And everyone applauded. and I said, can I get the house lights? Turn the house lights up. And I said, now here's the best part. I said, this is now way more entertaining than what I was just doing up here. So this is really great, because now we are all going to watch you as you either make the choice to stand up now and leave, or as we have security come in and escort you out. And either way, it's a better fucking show than what I was doing, for sure. And so, and I did that, and I waited until her and her group got up and left.
Oh, her whole group had to go too?
And right as they left, I said, Miss, before you go, next time you come to live performance, please make sure you don't come to disrespect the performer and, most importantly, the audience. Thank you very much.
Standing ovation.
Oh, and they, as soon as the door shut, I said, let's get back to the fucking show. And the audience was done. It was ready to go.
Well, that's the whole thing about the push and pull of a heckler. And once they get to a certain point, it's sort of like a funnel web spider trap where, you know, like, all right, good. You've just taken the wrong step and you don't even fucking know it. Because now the audience is against you.
Yeah.
And I don't have to attack you in any way. No. I can just let it happen and they will shame you and it's out of my hands.
Sure,
that's such a set. Like, I know exactly that moment where you get to go, everything's going according to plan.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you get to watch it.
There's a lot of that at the Magic Castle. There was recently an event with the guy who is doing his comedy magic show in the palace stage, and some one drunk guy was trying to get his attention, and for whatever reason, it didn't go well. Chipper Lowell climbed over across two people's seats and grabbed him by the arm and wouldn't let him go. The older gentleman grabbing the younger magician guy, and the stage manager, Brian, had to like come running out and grab the guy, and it was like a thing.
Yeah.
And so now we're having to put panic buttons in the different showrooms in different places.
Oh,
yeah, very
shit.
Serious. But it's a tricky thing. They can take it a little too far.
Well, especially, you know, the close-up magic room is incredible because it is so intimate. And for people who've never been to the Magic Castle, it is... if you just saw the room empty, you'd never go, you could put some type of performance in here. And it's just like, it's raised seating and it's a tiny room and you can see everything.
Super rigged seating. And I mean, that's the point with card magic, especially doing the Nothing to Hide show, is that all the seats have to be able to see the tabletop and be close enough to see the pips to know if it's a heart or a club. Because if you're too far back and he puts a hand over his card and it turns into a different card, it means nothing to you because you can't see the card.
Yeah.
So the logistics of those theaters are important.
Now, besides, obviously, if you're passionate about magic as an art form, what's the sort of business goal behind it? I mean, is it because, you know, there's not a ton of magic on television, and can you translate into other, you know, into other forms of media, or is it to tour a lot or get a residency somewhere, or what is the ultimate business-y goal?
I don't know. I'm not the businessman.
Yeah.
It's true.
I feel like I'm a bit of the Pied Piper of variety arts. Like, I constantly am crowing whether I'm hosting the Tonys and wanting people to see Broadway shows, or whether I'm doing magic stuff trying to get people. I want people to value seeing live things that are good.
Yeah.
And seeing them live.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's one thing to see Ricky Jay, who's fantastic. It's one thing to see his HBO special, which is great. But when you see that same show live and he's right there and he's talking to you and he's doing effects that you're, you know, you're 15 feet away from him and he's doing something really remarkable, then I think that that's, it has a bigger impact to you.
Yeah, live is that's all it is. We've had, individually and with this show together now, we've had several TV opportunities and things to do. You know, hey, come do a TV special, TV show, and we can't find a way to make it work for us in terms of, or make it work for magic, because it can be seen on TV, but it can't be experienced. And it has to be experienced live, like most great live performances.
We're too preconditioned now with the YouTube and the easy effects that can be done on iMovie or your phone to not think that there's trickery at every turn.
Well, it's not even just the trickery part, but it's also very hard to shoot stand-up for television because you just need to... It's a communal experience, and it's just better when you're in it.
Yeah, it's temporal. I think that a lot of it has to do with knowing that this is happening in the world right now at this moment and can never be reproduced in some way. Like, whether or not, I mean, he's going to tell the same joke, or do the same effect or something, it's I know that this is happening for me.
God, that's
right now.
That's almost like an endangered resource.
Absolutely.
of the experience of now and not taking it for granted, like, oh, I'll catch that on the internet later, of like knowing, oh shit, this is an unrecorded moment that I will just have to record with my mind.
Absolutely. And
it's
not
an experience.
Yeah.
And not only is the
live, another good word for that,
the live theatrical part where people show up to a theater, is that an experience that's happening in that moment, which is important. But also magic is one of the few things that forces you to recognize the moment, because it really confronts you with the world if you're doing it properly. And it confronts you with how the world is or how it should be or how you thought it was and it's not. And so you really have moments of introspection in a magic show that is like when a comedian says something really profound on stage that's not just a joke. It's like, holy shit, he's right about that truth. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really amazing thing.
A lot about that in the show, in Nothing to Hide, is the choices that we make and the ramifications of said choices.
But the idea of expressing a truth through a form of misdirection is really interesting.
No, that's all art.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
You know, all truth expressed through life. I mean, Picasso said something like that. You know, art is a lie that tells the truth.
Yeah, Picasso said art is cool.
I think he did.
No, I think he said actually. I think rad was the word that he used. Awesome. Yeah.
No, something about like art is a lie that tells the truth. You know, and I think it's true for all good art.
So if you don't use the word trick, what is the word that you use?
Trick. The only reason. Like that we would avoid the word trick is because it contextualizes it wrong in the sense that our goal is to, for a moment, to set aside your pessimism and negativity and bring back a little bit of that childhood wonder, as cheesy as it sounds. And trick always reminds you that it is a trick.
Mm-hmm.
It is just a trick. And it's we don't want to say, you know, and the next magics we be showing you, you know, it's like, but
effects,
and it's not, it's just, it's trick is a lot of time. And especially when talking to other people is what we end up saying.
Everything has its own vernacular. Everything kind of has its own. Oh, are you watching girls walk by the,
no,
you're watching
no.
pretty girls walk by the the outside. You know, the fucking unfair thing about it is the one guy in this room that could land that girl doesn't like girls. It's fucking not fair.
Maybe I already did land her.
Oh, shit.
That's awesome.
The only problem with tricks is that they're both prostitutes on the side.
Yes.
And so it gets confusing.
So there's a lot of, yeah. But as artists, aren't we all? But I think, you know, what I was going to say is that in any field, there's a vernacular that is different than what the public thinks. Like, you know, my dad owns a bowling center. If you say bowling alley, it puts him off a little bit because bowling alley is a very specific type of bowling
chapel,
establishment. Bowling chapel, he would love. But bowling alley it sort of elicits the idea of like a really dirty, grungy, you know, where bowling center is like a family.
Yeah.
And so, but you wouldn't know that if you didn't work in the business.
Yeah.
It's like that very personal.
The best is, and you know this from TV, is gag. that for some reason Hollywood has decided that the word for a magical effect is gag. And so, like, I don't care what set I've been on. It's like, what's the gag on this one? What's the gag? Show me the gag.
But what if the effects have a ball gag?
They usually
then
do.
Then it's get the gag. It's not what's the gag. You just know what the gag is.
Yeah.
Gag makes it all sound like...
Gag, but gag is just one step below trick. Oh, trick is...
I'll release the gimp.
We end up saying trick all the time.
So then let me ask you this. When you're...
But I'm offended already.
He's so mad. But when you're coming up with, so do you start with the story and then go, oh, this is a cool story. What effects could I build into this? Or do you start with the effects first and then build the story around that?
It really depends. We've worked both ways. I think if we start with the effect and build the story around, it's because that effect is really strong and there's a really interesting metaphor already built into it.
Yeah.
And that allows us just to understand that metaphor and translate it to the story around it.
Okay.
Okay.
What is considered hacky in magic? Like, what if you saw a magician do something, you're like, oh, that's hacky. That's hacky. Is there?
Oh.
There's a list.
Camera tricks.
Like what?
Is that hacky, though?
I find it hacky. I just find it easy. By hacky, to me, it just means super easy.
Super easy, like low hanging fruit.
Well, like I could film myself go to...
No, the clean one.
Yeah. Oh, jokes, those kind of jokes. Those lines. I mean, like I could go with a handheld camera to Universal City Walk and I could go up to someone and say, hey, let me show you a trick. And then I could like say, pick a card. And then I could say, is this your card? And then I would cut away to them. And then I could cut back and say, look, they're all blank. But right. I've just switched, like I've edited.
Sure.
Like editing tricks to me, that seems hacky as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it doesn't even sound like magic.
Right, yeah. But a lot of magic has become that a little bit.
I think
for me, it's like there is a lot of pattern and jokes that magicians use all the time.
Sure.
That's actually probably what throws me out more when seeing another magician. It's like, really? Are you going to really use this line? And oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then it's, I think, the choice of material. Like, you can see that, you can understand when a magician, all he's done for the last half year of his life is going into a magic shop, buying a trick, seeing a YouTube video where someone is doing that and copying that and doing on stage.
Sure.
Yeah, that happens a lot in magic.
I would imagine now, especially, how do you guys deal with, because comedians fucking hate it, the camera phones, like taking video during shows.
I'll punch them.
he just hits them.
Yeah. Why not?
I take the approach of explaining to them what it means, because I don't think people really ever thought about it.
They don't mean it, but in a bad way.
I bring it back to what we were saying earlier, and I have literally, this is what I say. I tell people and usually it doesn't matter even if it's going to interrupt the show because it becomes part of the show. I will tell them I noticed you're videotaping, and I said normally I don't permit that. Like I say it beforehand, like or it's people know that. But you're videotaping, which I'm not going to scold you for, but I just want you to know what that means. Because I said, what we're doing in this room is for us right now, and it's special, and we can't ever have it back. And once it goes away, it's gone, but at least we know we experienced it. And I said, and every second that leaks from this room diminishes the quality and the meaningfulness of what we're doing here. So you can keep filming if you want, but just know that every second that camera's on, it makes this a little less special.
He's going to be a great.
You're the most eloquent and articulate heckler basher I've ever. Okay, all. I just want everyone to understand.
I put them in the position because it's their choice, and I'm not. You know, I could tell them to put the phone down and explain to them why they're an asshole for filming, but it's a lot easier for you know the best lessons you learn are the ones you teach yourself.
All right, if I tried that approach, what would happen is I would say, listen, this is an experience, and if you want to make that choice, that's fine. And they'd go, okay, I'll keep recording. And be like, God fucking, you just fucking fuck you, you know, like.
And then you use Heller's method and you punch him in the face.
I did. I just had that in Tacoma. I was performing, and you're constantly scanning the room, just like make sure everyone's involved. And I saw a camera, like a phone up, and then when I scanned back, it was still up. And I was like, "Are you taking video?" And she was like, "Yes." I was like, what? Why? Well, just so I can watch it later with my friends. I was like, you're not so, you can't, come on. Yeah. And then, like, it was a very, like, she was so sweet. And then it just slowly went down. And, you know, I didn't want people to think I was a dick, but I was like, oh, you know, this is just for you guys. And it's like, if you put it out there, you know, it's, some of the stuff isn't ready to be in the world yet. And it's not going to make sense to other people who weren't here. And, you know, she just wanted to show it to her friends.
Thankfully, Derek and Helder's show, Nothing to Hide, is so good that I think anyone could film it and it would still be awesome. It's not like if they catch something
but
on
video.
But please
don't film it. That you didn't get permission.
No, of course not.
But right now. Just so you know.
I personally make an announcement before every show to not record or do anything. But what annoys me a little bit with magicians is that they'll, and I'm sure it's exactly the same in stand-up, is that someone will just watch something that Derek or Helder does and then go do it as their act. They'll just take their act and not give any credit and just do it.
Oh, yeah.
And
I would imagine there's even less respect in that community.
Because unbelievable.
No idea.
Because a joke, because they probably think, oh, it's a mechanism. It's like magic. It's for all of us.
Oh, it's brutal.
It's brutal. And magicians, I mean, stage magicians have tried to copyright all kinds of effects, and you can kind of get your way around it. But that's one of the things that I think is so awesome about what Derek and Helder are doing, is because their material is their material. They have come up with... Yeah. Their own unique methods for all kinds of things that you see. So you cannot buy any of the things that they're doing in their show. And frankly, the expertise level is high enough that you wouldn't probably be able to accomplish it anyway. But I love that forward thinking. My best friend is a guy named Ed Alonzo, who's a magician guy. And Ed, too, he'll have this funny idea and he'll like hire some guy to help him build some prosthetic thing that helps for his trick. And like he creates his own stuff and he'll go and he'll test it out and all places around the country, and he'll hone it and he'll make it a bit. If he doesn't love it, he'll try something else. But he has a lot of shit that's just his own stuff that he comes
up with. That's the thing that I do understand about really good magic, is that you guys are basically inventors at the same time, because
well, the good ones are.
That's
part of the death of magic, is that it's been turned over to the hobbyists, to the amateurs. Like it used to be that like the magician was the clockmaker who used to study under so and so, you know, and built these things that no one had ever seen, and they built forward thinking technology. And then once we fell behind technology, which all society did, it's so quick we can't keep up with it, you know, now it's that people, most magicians don't create their own material. They use other people's material and apply their own
spin
jokes.
It's not like you can just go to Nikola Tesla and get his machine that duplicates you at the top of the theater, and then you have to kill every time he falls through the stage.
Not since the incident.
I don't know why. I did not enjoy The Prestige when I saw it, but it's a movie that I still think about like years after having seen it.
It's a great book. I read the book like 4 years, 5 years before the movie came out, and I thought, oh, this would be a great movie. But no one's going to make a period movie about Tesla and two dueling magicians, you know, that's not cost effective.
God, if they had just...
And it was good, though.
The whole idea of like, wait a minute, so just all of a sudden this machine just happens to copy people and that's it?
Yeah.
That made me mad.
You could say that about a lot of movies, though.
Nope, just that one. Every other movie ever made was amazing. Just The Prestige.
I wish the people listening could see the magic. This is an interesting thing about this specific podcast, because we're talking about things that are visual in nature. You know what I mean? Like, you can't really...
Theater of the mind, Neil.
Well, I guess so.
You know what? He's Chris is right. No, it's true. And that's a lot of the thing that, like, people don't... It is a theater of the mind, in the sense that, like, people forget, like, that in our show, Nothing to Hide, Kevin Playhouse, that we are using cards, and people leave the show and no one ever talks about that. That's the last thing anyone talks about, that none of the reviews really mention that. Occasionally someone on a blog or something might mention that, but most people don't realize that that is all that's being used for playing cards, because of what's happening in their mind throughout the show is constantly taking them out of that headspace of the props and what's being seen, and it's the you know, the journey their imagination's taking them on.
But I will say, I think people, you know, definitely in comedy, certainly in magic, you sort of have to go in and surrender yourself. Like, some people forget that as an audience, you do have a responsibility, and your responsibility is to focus and hand your
energy
over to the audience and to the performer. I mean, obviously, if the former is bad, you don't have a, you certainly don't have a responsibility to stay invested. But there, you do have to do a little work on your part as an audience member. You can't just sit there and fold your arms and be like, "Fucking impress me." Like, you kind of need to come in a little open.
We totally agree.
We know that people will come in with their arms folded. And with that attitude, we expect that. Like, we aim for that level. Yeah. So our first, the first thing we do in the show is geared towards A, not building a wall between us, but a confrontation between Helder and I. Mm-hmm. So the conflict isn't between the magician and the spectator the way it usually is in a magic show right off the bat, where a magician comes out, tries to fool the audience. It is a competition of sorts between Helder and I. Where we sit at a table and we go head to head, and it's very, you know, the fourth wall is there, and so they feel it allows them to just settle in as like a play or something, and then the magic part of it is so brutal that they realize that even if they were in that headspace, they should just give up now. and the first piece is engineered to absolutely do that. So even if people are with their arms folded, and if the first one doesn't get them by the second one, game over. And so then now they're ready.
I think the nature of magic is that feeling of, I am the magician, I'm doing this, and I'm going to fool you. It's there. Like, even if we don't want to acknowledge it, it's there. And the audience going to a magic show, even if they like magic and even if they want to appreciate the magic part, there is a part of their brain that is always going to be trying to understand how we do it. Mm-hmm. But part of our task as a magicians is that too. It's to acknowledge that and make sure they understand. It's not, I don't think it's a give up situation. It's more a, you are losing more if you try to do that than if you try to enjoy the show.
Well, there's an emotional contract, really. When someone buys a ticket to a show, there is an emotional contract that you're all entering in, which is, you know, you come in to be led through this experience and I will lead you, but you have to be at least a little bit willing for that to happen. Yeah. And if you're not, then don't, you know, then maybe don't go.
That's more that way in magic, I think, than most.
I agree.
Because in stand-up, you're going out with your friends to have a good time. And with magic, there are two different schools of thought when people watch it. People that want to believe and want to just sit back and enjoy it, and people that are fucking hell-bent on figuring out how it was done.
Right.
And that at every show, at any magic venue, you'll get those two types of people. It's harder to ask an entire audience seeing magic to just go along with the ride and go along with the
journey. Very few people in stand-up go, how did he come up with that dick joke? Like, exactly, no one.
Right. No, you're just there to like,
God, farts are weird. I just, how did he make that turn? I always thought farts were fun. Exactly right. I didn't realize how weird they are. Like, or whatever the comic thing is.
But I find it impressive that these guys think that hard about carts. You know what I mean?
Well, I think an audience, you don't have to come out and say, like, look, we're very passionate about this thing that we're doing. Your performance relays that to them, and then they appreciate that. Even just on that level, they understand, like, oh, yeah, that's not fucking around stuff up there. That's, right. Like, this actually required some thought and innovation. And how do you innovate in magic? Especially, you know, at this point when it's so much of it has been done and so much of it has been broadcast, and people are like, so how do you continue to innovate?
It's a really hard question to answer. I think there is a point of you study enough and you learn enough and you practice enough, and at one point, if you've studied the right things and you've learned what you should learn and you understand, you start understanding magic, and when you start understanding magic, there is a point, there is I just call it a click point, where things start, like, you start interweaving knowledge that you've never thought before it was possible to. And you go back and you try to go, like, did anyone think about what I'm thinking now? Oh, no, wait. So, and you start following those little, like, that little way. And eventually you ended up, like, creating something new. And that said, it's like, this that I just described happened at so many levels. One of them is the technical part. You can actually create new techniques.
Mm-hmm.
It's like imagine a piano player. He has all the keys and he can play those keys the way you want to create the sound you want. But in Magic, it's like the piano can even be bigger than it's now, right now. So you can even extend that mm-hmm. piano. And then you use those keys to play the things you want to play and the way you want to play.
Well, the thing that I find so interesting about it is that you know, with stand-up, you can just go up on stage with kind of half an idea and go, well, you know, I'll find it. You know, I can't, because it's so much about the relationship with your audience, you can just sort of find where the bit is, but you guys have to have the technical part worked out so well before you even go up on stage, because you can't afford for it not to be.
Yeah, I mean that part is true. You gotta really work on it before you get it in front of an audience. But like for me, I got frustrated with the technical limitations of Magic, and so you know, for me, I just started asking new questions about what it is to be a magician and what it is to have a relationship with an audience as a magician, and what it is to be a magician in a modern society. And those new questions that I asked for myself, you know, found me in areas maybe not with new technology or new techniques, but maybe new ideas in relationship to magic. So, like, I try to, like, I've given, you know, I've not, I haven't given up on new technical innovations, but I think that like a new evolution of what a magician can be can perhaps provide new new ways of thinking about magic or new ways of performing magic.
What was the answer that you came up with? What does it mean to be a magician now?
I think learning how to acknowledge, to really be honest, brutally honest about what a magician. How a magician is perceived by modern society, and the new movie, Burt
Wonderstone.
That movie's coming out. That's the people say that's, you know, stereotypes, I don't think it's stereotypes. I think it's perception. I think it's actual perception of how the world sees magicians.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of looking at it as a stereotype and negative and like, oh, that's a, they're just there. It's a hyperbole.
Sure.
You go, no. What if Job from Arrested Development? What if this is the way. That, you know, no one portrays stand-up comics as like Gallagher hitting a watermelon anymore. Like
right.
That doesn't happen because that's not the perception. It's you know, it's you or, you know, Louis C.K. or Patton Oswalt and like real comics. People know what it is. And so I think magicians need to be honest with themselves and allow the world to be their mirror so they can take a look and then maybe start to change their clothes a little bit, and literally and metaphorically.
By the way, I didn't want to gloss over the fact I appreciate you lumping me with two much superior comics to myself, but I appreciate that. Even if you just said it because you're sitting across from me.
I did.
I appreciate that. I wouldn't have done the same thing.
When I'm in someone's house.
When you're in someone's house, you got to say, oh, this is the best.
You guys don't, Chris is a prop comic. You knew that, right?
Yeah.
He has like a...
Whoa, I've got to put my tie on and
by
go
the way,
to work.
I'd like to take this opportunity to formally apologize to Patton Oswalt and Louis.
For what?
Nothing.
I just
gloss over that.
Yeah, that's right. They don't listen to this.
can you guys do a trick for someone that's listening at home without them seeing anything? Is that doable? Is that putting you on the spot? Is there anything you can do?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's putting.
No, I know, but you're that good. I'm saying, could someone that's listening to this podcast like go home and like go into their kitchen shelf and get a deck of cards and then like do something that you tell them to do and have it be magical? Is that doable?
They can't hear us staring right now.
No, they could hear it.
Oh, they can hear it.
I'm the director of this goddamn show. Oh. No, they're just staring at each other. All right, forget it.
We have nothing but malice for you now. But other than that, we have nothing. We could talk through one. We could, like, describe it.
No, I just remember back in the days, I have all these old records of, like, classic magicians, and they would say, go and get a deck of cards. Now cut the cards into three piles. And it was all, like, audio magic. I didn't know if you could do any audio magic.
See, the problem with Neil is that
I'm a dreamer.
He's still really excited.
Finally, the podcast is about to start.
He's
60
really
minutes in.
Excited about magic. That's part of the problem of having Neil around is he's so excited about it, even more than not. Well, he's always the biggest magician in the room when the three of us are there, for sure. Because Helder and I, we're like, he's always like the first to be like, let's make it fucking magic. And we're like, dude, we just want to go get a burrito or something.
Yeah. We'll do some Chipotle magic.
He's like, he believes as much or more than anyone. So it's hard to keep at your level all the time.
Well, I love being fooled, and I love having that sense of wonder overwhelm me, whether it's with magic
just
specifically or frankly, some of my best euphoric feelings have been at Cirque du Soleil shows, at the Santa Monica Pier, mm-hmm. when it was like early style and it was Nouvelle Experience and it was David Shiner doing comedy in the middle of this giant theater space. And I just remember clapping so hard that my hands hurt and watching people do these amazing things. And us as a group were like wowed and entertained and in hysterics. And I just think that group vibe for something that's happening live is so exciting. So that's what I love about it and what I loved being involved with the directing thing. And with Cards especially, I don't think, you guys are kind of the exception because you perform a lot, but most people see card magic by their cousin in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And then they think it's all right and it's cool. And a lot of card performers only perform for very small groups of people. So it was sort of my job as a director to make sure that they were having the confidence to be able to perform for the front row, but also for the back row, and to keep it, it is my job. It's kind of my job to be more enthusiastic about them and to instill confidence in them that what they're doing is so great, which it is.
It's a technically fascinating idea of taking a close-up show and making it big.
Yeah, but it can't be that. That was my point earlier, is it can't ever be that big. We can't put a big projection screen behind them and show stuff where people will start to think that we're cheating.
How many does the Geffen hold?
Ours is 100, basically 100 seats.
Right at 100, yeah.
But we brought in special bleachers for the, so special seating and stuff.
Super raked seating, and we've had to, you may not know, but the table's on a bit of a rake. Yeah, the back two legs of the table we had to raise up a little bit just so when cards were flat, they look like they're flat, but they're actually a little bit of an angle, so you could see.
There's only one piece in the entire show that's close up. Everything else is
agreed.
Is stand up, and the only reason it's close up is because we're seated.
Mm-hmm. And it's that first piece, that silent
first
piece,
thing, which is silent.
It
relies heavily on the table. But everything else in the show is stand up, more or less. And so,
where do you tell them to get closer to the mic?
No.
And so
your mic just dripped a little bit.
Oh, okay.
It's not your fault.
You can lift it up.
It happens to a lot of guys.
I'll just lift it up.
Now it looks like you're blowing the mic.
It's fine.
I don't want you to have to hunch down.
Satisfying the mic. That's better.
This rickety old studio.
There it is. That's better.
Perfect. Now I really want to. The show will be. Is it running indefinitely, or did it just get picked up for another chunk of time?
We got picked up. When is this airing?
We'll put this up within the next week.
Okay, so we'll still be going, and we'll be through March.
Through March.
Through March is what it's.
There's a Neil LaBute play that's going on after it, and then the Geffen keeps pushing off Neil LaBute because the tickets are so sales are so good and the show's so awesome. So I think LaBute may have a conniption if it doesn't happen by April.
LaBute probably does not listen to this podcast either. Louie and Patton all hang out and don't listen to this podcast. Okay. Hey guys, you want to not listen to this podcast? Sure, Patton. Cunt, fuck, shit, tits. That was Louie. I don't know what LaBute would say.
That was a little bit LaBute as well.
Oh my God. Well, that's why they're all friends.
That's awesome.
No, it's been awesome that it's been so well received.
We're doing
that
our 100th show this week.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
How do you keep it fresh? How do you keep your show fresh?
Oh, we don't. It's stale. For sure. It's just the material is strong. So
but when it,
I'll tell you exactly how it's structured so well that this first piece that they mention gets the audience in a headspace of like their minds are already kind of blown, that then they get to have fun with some verbal dexterity, some thought processes that I think people don't tend to think about. And you get a group to be in a headspace that keeps it from being stale.
We love it is the answer.
I've heard two things during this podcast so far that would make great album titles. Number one, Brutal Magic.
Nice.
Number two, Verbal Dexterity.
Nice.
Those are good bands, yeah.
I don't think that thought processes is an actual term.
Thought processes?
Processes? Is that a word? Processes? That doesn't sound right coming out of my mouth hole.
It's Greek. It's Greek term, processes.
Processes.
Processes was the Greek goddess of
magic.
Of brutal magic. She had an incredible verbal dexterity. But I also want to take this opportunity to say, and I know this is a little shilly on my part because it's on our channel, but I really mean this sincerely, but Neil's Puppet Dreams is fucking awesome. And what you guys were able to do in 3 days with a Bollywood number is fucking nuts.
Anyone who hasn't seen this Bollywood number, that was like our pièce de résistance. We were very excited. It was the last one that we aired because we thought it was our best, you know, 4.5-minute sketch that we did on Neil's Puppet Dreams. And I thought, 5 million hits. I thought for sure it's going to like be this viral thing. And it's got like 150,000 hits.
That's still a good...
It's not a good number.
Okay, so for Neil Patrick Harris, maybe not. But for the rest of the...
It's not a good number.
150,000.
The fucking kid who went to the dentist... And is sitting in his back seat.
That was pretty great, though. Is this real life? I mean, come on.
That's 20 That's million my
cousin.
Hits.
That's your cousin.
I mean, we filmed
a
video.
No.
I'm just saying, anyone who hasn't seen it, go see Neil's Puppet Dreams, the Bollywood number. It's awesome. I fall in love with a cow.
New love will make its debut.
Yeah, I go down on a puppet cow. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, that number's going up.
Yesterday, I was actually talking about puppet improv.
Have you seen the live Henson?
No, I've never.
It's
seen
really
it.
Good.
That's them's the puppets.
Which is
puppet improv. It's a pretty cool concept.
It was called Stuffed and Unstrung, called Puppet Up, and then it became Stuffed and Unstrung. But what's fascinating about the puppet improv is that they've conceded to the audience: you're going to see the puppeteers, and so they have a camera up front and they have monitors, so you can see the puppeteers, but then you can also just watch on screen. But even that is an interesting form of misdirection because there's no way to hide the way that it works, so it's just all in the jokes and the performance.
There's nothing to hide.
Oh. That should be the name of a
show.
Oh, it all comes around in a giant, delicious circle. I am gonna go see Nothing to Hide.
You must.
I will.
Tonight?
I can't go tonight.
Fucker.
We don't have tickets for tonight.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, now I want to go. It's part of the LA mentality. What do you mean I can't get in? No, I have to. No, I'm going
to
get
in. We'll see it soon, and then you have to,
Are you going
to
tour the show?
Oh, no, tour right now, probably not, but we're going to New York, I'm sure.
That's the goal, but we still don't.
We don't have any.
It's the great hem-haw conversation that we're all having right now because going to New York would be great. It's kind of like that's the end goal for any kind of smallish theater piece, especially magic, which isn't represented in New York in this capacity very often. But again, you're dealing with logistics. What theater can you do that everyone can see the cards?
Right.
You know, you can't do a Broadway house. That's 1,000 seats. Couldn't do it. So we're trying to think.
Well, we can, but we get a lot of people that are going to be pissed.
Yeah, you'd have
to
hand
it off
with
glasses. It's also the economics of a show where you can really only have 100 people.
True.
Yeah. And it's
what can you charge?
Yeah.
You know,
everyone doesn't lose money.
What was the time period for the old parlors and houses? What was that, like turn of the century, 1920 or something, where people had as a proper form of education? Yeah, I guess
before
proper form of entertainment, you would bring, you know, 30 people into your parlor and you would all sit and you would watch a magician or a cellist or something. Like those smallish kind of venues were prevalent back then.
Or you had to be fun employed to bring that by back. Some crazy royal family.
Yeah. We need to find a royal family in New York.
Yep.
Hired
royal families listening to this podcast. We are searching for
you. Are
there
a few?
You know, I've just been listening to the most interesting audio cast.
Oh, how ducky. Let's hire them.
We can. We're royal, you know. I don't know what country.
Pip-pips.
We're the Prince of Central Park.
The play on words, because cards have pips on them.
See, that's very inside magic talk.
You.
I don't know what that... I didn't know that.
He's in the know.
Didn't know that. That was a good gag. God damn it. Derek, why are you...
I just pip. I'm shaking my head.
Yeah.
Fucking magic hipsters.
I do a lot of comedy at Derek's expense.
My sadness makes him smile.
Is it... Was there any point when you're directing the show and then you're like, and then I should come out with the number, and they're like, Neil, come on.
We'd love that.
We actually thought about that, saying, hey, Neil, come just do the 100 performance. And in the middle of the show, just walk through the stage and walk out.
Just love it.
Without I'll be there. Anything. Just stand up.
You see the rap he did at the end of the Tonys a couple years ago?
I know. It's unbelievable.
It's a strange thing directing someone's show and they have written said show. I've done a couple of those, especially magic based, because it's you have to direct with a very soft hand because you can't say like, no, do it this way, right? Because it's their creation,
it's their material. Yeah.
They came up with it. So it was a lot of like, what do you guys prefer, this or that? Or from you're doing this and I'm taking that from it. Is that what you're intending? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you have to direct in a very specific way when it's like directing a one man show and then asking for cuts.
Right.
It's like they wrote it. So that's been fun.
Yeah.
But cool.
Well, you guys have to trust each other to a certain you have to not mash your point of view onto their thing.
Correct.
Which is very hard because I'm sure you have some ideas and.
Well, but my ideas are trumped by their awesomeness. So it makes it kind of easy in this case.
So then what do you do as a director? Are you just essentially a sound? Are you like a workshop audience for them in a sense?
I think I have a good gauge of what an audience would be taking from a given moment. And I think that I've gained their confidence in that. So if I'm able to say like, that's confusing to me, or when you're saying that, I don't think I'm getting what you're trying to accomplish, then they take note of that and try and reword it in a certain way or just symmetry with blocking and things like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, we know what he's capable of on a stage. So when Neil says something, like, I know that he's also seeing it through the eyes of being where I'm at, like as a performer, not just as a director. Like I know he's able to be on stage and see and know, and knows what it is to get a crowd on its feet and to get them going and stuff. So I think I know he sees it with that lens too, where he's able to see it from a performer's point of view, not just a director's point of view or a writer's point of view. So there are times where I'm like, he's right. I'm sure he's right because this is a performative, field we're playing on. So he's done a thing or two.
But I'm happy to be wrong.
And a lot of times
for real. Like, I'll say some note, and I'll say if that doesn't make any sense, and it's screwing with your head, then
actually,
don't do it anymore.
Actually, more of his notes are always questions. It's like, why are you doing that? And if we have a good reason to do that, you'd say, oh, okay, I get it.
I think that's probably, and I'm not a director, nor will I ever be, but I think that's, my guess is that's the best, well, I mean, I produce stuff. That's the best way, is to have the person whose thing it is just question it in a way that maybe they wouldn't have before.
I tend to start everything that I direct by letting the actors know, well, probably everyone know, that I'm going to ask a lot of why questions, but oftentimes people will take a why question with an agenda and to not have any agenda. So if I say, why are you saying it like that? I'm not meaning like, why the fuck are you saying it like that?
Yeah.
I'm meaning like, what are you trying to accomplish by saying that?
Yeah.
So I'm having to speak in more specific words than
get a lot of, why are you not doing what I told you to?
Why would you want me to kill this show?
Why are you failing?
Why am I working with you?
Actually, the best part was, because we have the magic part and then we have the part that is the performance part, and we are all working on that. And we kept hiding from Neil some of the secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the times Neil went, okay, just tell me everything now. And it was like this moment.
Well, that's a funny, interesting thing with magicians, is that magicians won't often reveal how much they actually know about stuff, because it kind of reveals their knowledge.
I think he often thought we were hiding more than we were, too. Like,
so it's not. I didn't want to come in and say, like, all right, show me how this is done. I sort of acted for a couple of the things. Like, I get it. And I knew that stuff was happening, but I wasn't sure exactly the methodology behind it. But after a certain point, people were asking me if I knew how everything was done. And I was like, oh, absolutely. But in my heart, there were things I didn't really know. So I did have to sit them down and say.
Performance 80, he walks up. He's like, show me the box.
I did.
It's really funny.
I did, but I felt like I had earned that
at that
question.
Point.
Yeah. There's only about six people that know the answer to that question.
I mean, that's got to be a magician's. That is the most vulnerable you can be, I would imagine, when you're revealing that.
Well, unfortunately, that is where all of the energy is put, is into the secret. Like in our show, we can
you know, there are many pieces in the show where we could give the secret away, and I don't think it would take much from the piece because you'd go, are you fucking kidding me? That's how that works?
It like, still it's looks
still
cool.
Still unbelievable. Yeah. But a lot of times when the secret is just the secret and that's all the performance is hinged on, that's when it becomes so defensive. And like,
I think part of the reason why I think people really like our show, it's because they know the secret. It's not something you can buy or you can do.
Right.
Something like very few people in this world can actually do and can actually get to that level. So in that sense, like it makes it, they know the separation. It's not a little separation. It's a big gap. And because of that, they just don't want to know how the secret.
Well, and for me, it wasn't eating away at me, like not knowing how the things that I was unaware of. It wasn't like things that I was trying to find out. Like I appreciated that something was going on at this moment. And I was more interested in getting accomplished, right? Mm-hmm. And I hoped that through the minutiae of hanging out, I would learn how things were done.
It's a big ruse. I'll produce your show, but you have to tell me your secrets.
That should have been a rider.
Well, so what is the so people just go to Geffen Playhouse website, or is there a Nothing to Hide website, or can people follow you on Twitter, or what's this?
They can follow us on Twitter. We have
Twitter handles. Go.
Oh, @ Derek, DEREK _ Dell. Derek Dell.
Derek Dell. He's a great one to follow. He has lots of interesting things to say.
Mine is @ whoiselder.
Like a question. Who is Helder?
No, nothing. Who is Elder?
Not who is Elder.
And the Geffen Playhouse.
Who is Helder? WHOISHELDER.
The Geffen Playhouse. You type.
I think it's geffenplayhouse.com.
Yeah, geffenplayhouse.com. And they have tickets.
They keep extending, and sometimes there's like even specials for good price tickets and stuff. So, yeah, just keep your eye. Gold Star has stuff.
From time to time.
I'm actually MPH on Twitter.
Actually MPH on Twitter.
Holla.
Neil's Puppet Dreams, Bollywood. But I appreciate, I mean, I always love talking to people who are, you know, masters at something, but just hearing where it comes from and the passion and really hearing the human side, trying to understand it from that. And then Neil and I, you and I are very alike because I'm a loudmouth about stuff I love and I get very excited about, like, you guys, why doesn't everyone know about this thing that I love too? You know?
Yeah.
So I appreciate that you...
I will. Thank you. Thank you for having us. And I will say that if people are listening...
I gotta join the Magic Castle.
We have associate memberships. They're not that expensive.
Okay.
We'd love to have you. I'll treat you well. I will say that if people have listened to this and are interested, it is a kind of once-in-a-lifetime experience to see the show. These two guys, I can't say that they're so good enough because it's really that good.
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming, you guys.
Peace out, Saga.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Enjoy your magical burrito. I'm the royal family from New York.
Hello. I've heard about your show on a podcast.
I would like a court magician and a burrito.
I happen to have two parlors.
One is hidden behind a bookcase.
Could you perform in a repertory?
I don't know what country we're from.
Are you doing Taylor Swift?
I'm Latvian.
Are you doing Taylor Swift? Did you say?
Yeah, from the Grammys.
Is that what you're doing?
That's so funny. It's this voice that goes into, she wears these dresses, I wear these pants.
What is that song that she sang? I don't, no one, nowhere. What was the song that she sang?
Nowhere.
I'm not my boyfriend anymore. What's that? You're not my boyfriend any song. It was just sitting right here.
Squeeta, squeeta, da 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 da. Taylor Swift doesn't listen to the podcast either.
Apparently, not anymore.
No, fuck, we just lost her. She's going to try to date the podcast. And it's not going to go well. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 15% off your new account for 6 months, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code Nerdist2, that's Nerdist and the number 2.